Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you from the Rocky Mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado. I am your host, Mark Troutman, CFP. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. In this episode, I wanted to talk about the topic of overcoming frugality after reaching financial independence. And that may sound odd, but for many people who are seeking financial independence, they typically have a frugal mindset or a saver mindset. And that was what enabled them to become financially independent in the first place. So typically you're earning an income and you're saving a percentage of that income, potentially even a high percentage of that income. And that approach to life gets ingrained in your mind for, in my case, decades prior to reaching financial independence. And what many people find in this community, once they've reached financial independence, it's very difficult to shift your mindset from that saving and investing mentality to learning really how to spend your money that you've accumulated over the years, because effectively that's what it is. It's deferred spending, all of these assets that you've accumulated during your accumulation years. And it's very difficult to switch that in your brain. And I found one way to enable myself to overcome that, and it's called the fun bucket. So I wanted to talk about the fun bucket, which is basically a way to enable yourself to spend money without guilt, I guess you would say, kind of guilt-free spending, very much like Ramit Sethi says on the I Will Teach You to Be Rich podcast and book. I have also found that it can be applied to charitable giving as well. So I want to talk about donor advised funds in the second part of this show. So first, the question is, what is the fun bucket? How did it come about? And how am I using it? So I need to give you a little bit of a backstory. I retired at the end of 2015, thinking I was probably financially independent, but I wasn't 100% sure. But it seemed like that was the case. I hadn't done a lot of math around it. I've talked about this on prior episodes where I left my job. I ended up getting my CFP, doing the coursework, doing some math, and realizing I was probably financially independent. But it was still very difficult for me to get comfortable spending that money. I was very nervous. I was nervous about running out of money. I was unsure whether I really did have enough money. How would I start drawing on this portfolio? How should I spend? And so forth. And I avoided it for the first 2 years. I had a classic vehicle that I sold, which enabled me to avoid drawing down for the first year. In the second year, I received a payout from my prior employer, which I never really counted because it was a private company. I never expected, or I never knew exactly when and if it would be paid out. It wasn't a huge sum by any means, but it was enough to avoid drawing on my portfolio in year two. And during these 2 years, I just went down the rabbit hole, as many people in the financial independence community do, figuring out what is a safe withdrawal rate, how do I account for sequence of return risk, can I live by the 4% rule or guideline. I really dove into the blog Early Retirement Now. Karsten Jeske, also known as Big Earn, has done a very in-depth, very detailed series on safe withdrawal rates. And I really appreciate all the work that he did or has been doing on this subject. And I got very comfortable with his kind of 3.25% safe withdrawal rate. I also read a number of papers from places like Morningstar that talks about safe withdrawal rates as well, white papers and so forth, and doing things like skipping an inflation adjustment if your portfolio went down in a year. So I was kind of like, oh, well, I will withdraw at 3.25% and skip inflation adjustments after any year where the portfolio declines, for example, and that will just make everything super, super safe. But I still wasn't withdrawing at anywhere close to 3.25%. In fact, it was well below 2%. If you do that for an extended period of time, all you're going to do is really continue to accumulate assets and maybe not live your best life as a result. In the fall of 2021, and this is kind of how the fund bucket came to be, I was going to a Camp 5 Southwest, and I was staying at my friend Kevin's house in San Diego, or in Encinitas, actually. I flew in early, I stayed at his house, and we stayed up very late in the evening, and we were just talking about drawdowns and portfolios and asset allocation and all the things that financial independence geeks talk about late into the evening. And he asked me what I was withdrawing from my portfolio, and I told him it was under 2%. This is the fall of 2021. This is nearly 6 years after I left my full-time employment, or really only employment. I was not earning any money since then, and I was still withdrawing a very low amount of my portfolio. And he was recounting that, hey, look, the market has done very well in your first 5 years of retirement. You didn't even withdraw in year one and two. You're withdrawing under 2% in the subsequent years, and your portfolio has grown in the meantime. You have not had a bad sequence of returns. You need to loosen the purse strings. And he said, you need a fund bucket. I was like, a fund bucket? What is a fund bucket? And he said, basically, you need to segment some of the cream off the top of the cake that at this point not only has cream, but it has sprinkles and everything else that goes with it. Because you have not had a bad sequence, you need to take some of that off the top, move it out of your FI portfolio into a separate account, label it fund bucket, and allow yourself to spend. Like Ramit suggests, guilt-free spending. Because what I was doing is I was always rationalizing every bit of spending. Should I? Shouldn't I? Well, I don't really need to spend money on that. It's frivolous or it's unnecessary. And the suggestion was put it in a separate account, label it fund bucket for those things that are over and above your basic needs and even things that are beyond basic needs. So I did that. After that campfire, I went home, I opened the fund bucket, and what I have found, it's been very liberating. And so what is the fund bucket used for? Well, it's interesting. I belong to the Rock Retirement Club, which is Roger Whitney, who is the Retirement Answer Man podcast host. He has this club, and I went to the annual meetup there. And Kevin Lyles, who is one of the mentors, I guess you would say, in the Rock Retirement Club, he actually had a breakout session called Overcoming Frugality. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect. He wasn't talking about the fund bucket specifically, but he was talking about allowing yourself to spend on some small indulgences that you wouldn't ordinarily do to retrain yourself to be comfortable with spending. Some of the things we discussed were, for instance, staying in a nicer hotel maybe, or hiring a house cleaner, or even potentially upgrading your seats on your next flight, whether it be economy plus or first class even. At that point, I realized that's how I need to use this fund bucket. Spend on things that I'd prefer not to do, like house cleaning. And it did take me a while to hire a house cleaner, but now I do have a house cleaner. Flying in a better class. So now I always upgrade to at least economy plus, for example, and frequently will fly first class. The frugality mindset is with me in that I will only do it if I think it makes reasonable sense. I won't do it at any cost. And that's something I probably still need to work on. And or even let's say you're out with friends and maybe you pick up the tab at the restaurant. I don't do that every single time, but it is something I have certainly done. And it has enabled me to spend a lot easier. And I know that this is also a common challenge for people in the FI community. In fact, Mindy Jensen of the Mindy on Money podcast reached out to me this week saying that they will be talking about this specific subject on their episode that releases this same week. So I will put a link to their show in the show notes. They are going to discuss this in more detail. When they were over at my house a while back, we talked about this at length. And I know this is something that they're working on as well. And I know a lot of people in the financial independence community have read the book Die with Zero by Bill Perkins. And he talks about the idea of enjoying your resources while you have the ability and health and everything to be able to do that so you don't have any regrets. I agree 100% with that. And for me, it's not things, it's experiences. And that is something that I've really been able to utilize this fund bucket for. And what I've also found is that many of the expenses that I am telling myself, oh, that's what the fund bucket is for, go ahead and say yes to whatever that is, actually, in many cases, are fitting in with my normal kind of spending pattern anyway. But if I didn't have that fund bucket, I wouldn't have made that decision, or if I did, I would have been going back and forth, should I, shouldn't I? But now it's so much easier to just say yes to things. So I've done a number of, and they all, for the most part, are experiences. I have a number of cruises that I have done and will be doing, and the people I am doing them with, in many cases, have their own fund buckets. So it's very easy for us to just say, let's do this without anyone saying, well, I don't know, let me think about it. In most cases, we're just like, yes, let's do it. That's what this money was set aside for. Let's do this. And I'm also finding that in many of these, or a number of these instances, my daughter is joining me on some of these trips. And we're creating memory dividends, as Bill Perkins kind of outlines in his book, together. And it's not just the experience itself and the memory dividends that come from post-experience, but it's also the lead-up to that. In fact, my daughter and I were on the phone last night talking about the cruise we will be doing with other friends later this summer to the Mediterranean, and you get enjoyment in the pre-event period as well. And so some people ask me, well, how big is the fund bucket? And I also did write a blog post on this a while back, and I'll link to that in the show notes. But I don't like to give specific numbers because I like to talk about things from the standpoint where other people can relate to this. So my numbers may be relatable or may not be relatable to other people, but I like to think of things in percentage terms frequently. So for me, it was about 25% of my kind of annual spending rate is what I wanted to put into this fund bucket per year. And I chose to do it for a 4-year period. And right now I am about 3 years into it. I have actually spent pretty substantially on fun things, experiences, what have you, but I haven't depleted it to the extent that I would have expected to by this point, but it is definitely about half empty at this point. So I'm a little behind, I guess you would say, but I've actually been spending at a rate that actually slightly exceeds how much is in there on a kind of a run rate basis. And so it was 25% of what I've been spending outside of fun items. And I funded it for 4 years. I put it in a separate online savings account. Previously, I've mentioned Ally as a place where I have an online savings account with different buckets. Initially, it was one of the buckets in that Ally savings account, but I decided actually to open a separate account for this particular purpose because I didn't want even the ability to easily move money from one bucket to another and just say, oh, I'll take it out of the fun bucket and slide it over to this other bucket that I have for some other spending goal. I wanted it to be completely 100% separate. So I've done that. And once it is depleted, I plan to replenish it. In fact, I've already gone through the exercise of identifying where specifically those funds will come from so that it is there for me to refill this bucket. And I've just found it to be so much easier to spend on things that were normally outside my comfort zone. And I have, I think, retrained myself. My brain has been retrained. For instance, last night, as a matter of fact, I was talking to my daughter and we have two flights. We are flying from Denver to Newark, New Jersey, and then from Newark to New Jersey to Europe. And the Europe portion of the flight is scheduled by the cruise company, but we ended up getting our own ticket to Newark, New Jersey, because my mother is going to join us and we want to be on the same flights. Long story, but that's what we're doing. And I just called her last night and I said, hey, you know, the first class upgrade is pretty reasonable at this point. I think we should just do it. And that's what the fun bucket is for. So we made that decision in minutes and said, yeah, let's do it. If I had to decide, was this coming out of my normal paycheck? Should I, shouldn't I probably would have leaned towards not doing it and just saying, it's a 4-hour flight. Do we really need to fly first class? But since we're going to be flying two legs and the second leg is over 9 hours, I was like, no, that's what it's for. This is what we should do. And so that's what we decided to do. I have also utilized this same concept for charitable giving. Now, here's an interesting way to think about this as well. So the fun bucket is basically money that's been put aside. It has a specific purpose and it's there for that purpose. Now, when it comes to charity, I would say I was charitably inclined during my accumulation years, but not to the extent that I would have liked. I have found that creating a charitable bucket is also beneficial because once the money is in that charitable bucket, it's been identified for a specific purpose and it's very easy to utilize. So what I decided to do was open a donor advised fund for two primary reasons. One is once the money goes into your donor advised fund, and I'll talk a little bit about them in a moment specifically, but once the money goes into a donor advised fund, it is a completed gift. You cannot take that money back, for example. And the second thing is there is a tax advantage in using a donor advised fund. And that certainly as a tax optimizer was of interest to me. So that's where I want to spend a little bit of time on how donor advised funds work. But the idea of having money in this kind of, you could really call it a personal foundation that has already been funded from your resources. You can't take it back. It's sitting there. It's so much easier to give when there's money sitting in an account for the specific and sole purpose of charity to say, yeah, I want to support that charity. And in fact, this past week, I was in town at an event. It was an event for mental health purposes, suicide prevention, and they were looking to raise a certain amount of money from the community, and they were a little bit short of their goal. And so it was very easy to just go up there. They were very close to their goal, but they weren't quite there. And I just walked up and said, you know what? I'll get you over that finish line. Let's do it. And I was able to make the donation from my donor advised fund. And it was very easy to do it. I was thinking back, would I have made that donation if it would have required me to reach into my pocket and make that donation at that point in time? I wasn't really familiar with the organization. I probably would have been more hesitant to donate. I had already donated some cash that I had in my pocket, for example, but this was quite a bit larger donation than that. I probably wouldn't have done it. But having that donor advised fund was like, yeah, it's sitting there. Why not? Let's get them over that finish line. Let's make this happen for them. So that's very similar to having a fund bucket. So I view the donor advised fund kind of in that same realm of a fund bucket. So let's talk a little bit about donor advised funds. There are a handful of firms out there that allow you to create your own donor advised fund. The three that I researched when I was looking at the idea of setting one up were Fidelity, Charles Schwab, and Vanguard. So I will talk about those three, but obviously there are plenty of other firms out there that will enable you to create a donor advised funds, but these were the three that I was looking at when I went to set mine up. So I want to give you a little bit of a comparison of those. Now, I already had an account at Fidelity, so that was certainly in the mix of my kind of thought process. I also had accounts or have accounts at Vanguard. So those two were of primary interest, but I wanted to make sure I looked at Schwab as well. And I actually do have an account at Schwab, but that was actually set up after I decided to create my donor advised fund. So the three firms, and again, I just have information about these three. There are plenty of other firms out there. I have no affiliation of these firms. Do your own due diligence. But I just want to give you some of the parameters of these donor advised funds and how they work. So account minimums. Fidelity and Schwab do not have an account minimum. You can open it up with a nominal amount. Vanguard has a $25,000 account minimum to open it. So that was a little bit of a hurdle. I actually did fund mine with more than that, so that was not an issue. And I'll get to the funding in a minute. But this next issue was a little bit more of an issue for me. So the minimum grant that you can make. So basically what happens is you contribute to your donor advised fund, and then you go into the donor advised fund and you say, I want to make a grant to this, and it has to be a 501c3 charity. Either it's listed in their list of charities, or if it isn't, you can give them the information and they can research it and make sure it's a 501c3 and then add it to their list and then make the donation. But Fidelity and Charles Schwab, the minimum grant is $50. Vanguard's minimum grant is $500. And I wanted to be able to make donations because I make some smaller donations than $500. Between the minimum, which really wasn't applicable, but the minimum grant was definitely something that swayed me to not go with Vanguard, for instance. So Fidelity and Schwab still tied here. The administrative fee. Obviously, these firms, there's costs to administer these. They've got to do the research. They've got to send these checks out or wire the money out. There's effort on their behalf. All three firms have the same administrative fee. It's 0.6%, which is 60 basis points of the balance in the account. That's the administrative portion of the expense. And they all charge that up to a balance of $500,000. And there are breakpoints where it goes down if you have more than $500,000 in donor advised fund. I don't intend to have more than $500,000 in my donor advised fund, but you can go online and see the differences. And I think I will post links to all three of these. Again, I'm not advocating for any of them particularly, but I will put the links in the show notes. And then there's a minimum, however. If, for instance, your balance is so low that 60 basis points or 0.6% isn't more than a certain amount, they will charge you a minimum fee. For Fidelity and Charles Schwab, that minimum fee is $100. And for Vanguard, the minimum fee is $250. So again, that was a check mark for Fidelity and Schwab over Vanguard. And then you can choose specific funds for your dollars to be invested in, and I'll explain that in a moment, but they all have very low-cost index funds, for example, so they're all very similar in that respect, and these are like 2 basis point, 5 basis point index funds. They do have more expensive funds in the portfolio that you can choose from, but I choose the low cost fund. So that portion of the cost is de minimis. And so the way it works is this. You could give cash. You could write a check and open your donor advised fund, but there's a better way to fund it if you have the ability to do so. And that is through donating appreciated securities. So I actually had some low cost basis stock in my taxable brokerage account that I used to make the donation, because one option would be, if that was the intended funding source, I could sell the shares, right? But then I would have to pay capital gains tax on it. Or I could just donate the shares in kind, and then the charity gets the entire value of that, in my case, stock. And then what they end up doing is they sell that stock immediately. They don't want to keep XYZ stock. As soon as they receive it, they sell that stock. But they don't pay any tax because it's a charity. You are donating to a charity. The donor advised fund is technically a charity. And then those funds show up in your account, and then you can select from their list of funds that are available and make the investment how you choose. And so what happens is, on the front end, when you make this donation to the donor advised fund, you get the full tax deduction of that donation in that tax year. And that's what's so interesting about how these funds work, because, as you may be aware, in order to take a tax deduction for charitable contributions, let's say you're giving $500 to this charity, $1,000 to this charity, $200 to this other charity, collectively, the only way to get a tax deduction on that is to itemize your deductions on your return. Now, the standard deduction is quite high. So you basically need to get over the standard deduction in order to make any of your charitable contributions worthwhile from a tax deduction standpoint. Obviously not worthwhile for the charitable portion and the benefit for the charity, but just purely from the tax deduction standpoint, you really need to get over that standard deduction amount in order to benefit from the tax deduction. The key items on itemized deductions are medical expenses, but only the portion that exceeds 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, which is a pretty substantial hurdle. You would need to have some pretty significant medical costs to really get any deduction on your tax return. The second area is taxes that you pay. So those would include state and local taxes. So either income taxes or general sales tax, not both, one or the other, you have to choose. Real estate taxes and any personal property taxes. So in Colorado, for example, we have to pay personal property tax on our vehicles if they're less than 9 years old. So that's included. However, there's a cap of $10,000. No matter how much of that you have, you cannot deduct more than $10,000. And that's true for both singles and for married couples. So actually, getting to the itemized deduction limit of $14,600 is a little easier for singles, because this state and local tax limit, SALT limit, is the same whether you're single or married, but married couples have to get all the way up to $29,200 in deductions to make it worthwhile to itemize, for example. The third section is any interest you paid. So that would typically include, for most people, home mortgage interest and points and things like that. But for most people, it's really just home mortgage interest. So if you have a large mortgage, you might be able to, and there's no limit on that. And then the next section is gifts to charity. So that would also come into play. But in order to get over this, so for singles, $14,600, or for married couples, $29,200, even if you had $10,000 in taxes that you paid, for example, singles still need to come up with another $4,600. Maybe it's mortgage interest, for example, and or gifts to charity to itemize versus taking the standard deduction. And many married couples, just they're not going to get there. And so actually around, I think the number is somewhere around 90% of people, of tax filers, take the standard deduction. So this is where the donor advised fund comes into play. You can deduct any charitable contributions you made in the year. So let's say you open a donor advised fund and you say to yourself, you know, I make $5,000 of charitable contributions every year. What if I were to batch those? You could do it by telling, let's say, your group of charities, hey, you know what? I'm going to give you money this year, which is equivalent to five times what I normally would, but I'm not going to give you any money for the next 4 years. Well, you could do that and you could lump them all and then take potentially a larger deduction for those charitable contributions in that 1 year. But many charities would prefer to get it over the years. And they're also going to be like, hey, you gave us $25,000 last year. How come you're not giving us anything now? Alternatively, you could donate $25,000 to your donor advised fund. It sits in there. It can also continue to be invested in those funds within the donor advised fund. And then over the course of the next 5 years, you can donate that money as you see fit to those charities, and it can continue to be a very smooth distribution of those assets to those charities, yet you got the tax deduction in that 1 year. So what you could do, and this is what I've been doing, is you do a large donation, preferably with stock that has a large capital gain, for example, donate that to the donor advised fund, take the tax deduction in that year. In the following years, you take the standard deduction until you're ready to do it again. And then in another year down the road, you do it again and take the deduction in that 1 year. So you're taking the standard deduction in most years. And then occasionally you'll take the itemized deduction when you make that large contribution to your donor advised fund every so many years. Now, there is a limit to how much you can donate, and it's based on your adjusted gross income. So if you donate cash, you can donate up to 60% of your adjusted gross income and take the tax deduction in that 1 year. If you donate more, you have to spread that deduction over following years. And if you donate appreciated securities, which is really the more optimal way to fund it, you can donate up to 30% of your adjusted gross income. So what I ended up doing is I did it in a year where I had some large Roth conversions for two reasons. One is I had a higher adjusted gross income because I did some large Roth conversions. So my 30% window was larger effectively. And then secondly, I was also in a higher tax bracket because of those conversions. So the money that I was able to deduct from itemizing my deductions was reducing a higher tax bracket amount. So that was the year to do it. I will likely continue to do that in years where I have a high income year, in my case, primarily because of conversions, for example. And then also maybe in a year where I have enough so that I can get close to that SALT limit, state and local tax limit of $10,000. Plus any other deductions that I may have. So if I had a large medical expense here, which again, it would have to be a pretty significant amount. Hopefully I don't have that. Or if there was a reason where I knew I was going to be very close to the standard deduction, I would be able to say, hey, this is the year to do that contribution to my donor advised fund. In the interim, I have securities that are in my taxable brokerage account that I have mentally earmarked for that purpose. And hopefully they will continue to grow and create additional unrealized gains. And then I can donate that appreciated stock to the donor advised fund. Getting back to using this as a way to overcome frugality, I found very beneficial. So the fund bucket is for the benefit of myself and maybe some friends and family. And the donor advised fund is for the benefit of others. Please don't send me your request for money from my donor advised fund. I have charities that I specifically support. They tend to be local charities. I prefer supporting charities in my own community primarily. And so please avoid sending me requests from my donor advised fund. It is not anywhere close to $500,000, for example. It is much smaller than that. And of course, donor advised funds must contribute to a 501c3. Don't say, I need help with my broken arm, please send me money. That doesn't work that way. And you also can't use your own donor advised fund for that purpose. It must be a 501c3 organization. And technically, the organization that is effectively custodying your donor advised fund has the right to decline any request of yours, but I've not seen that. But if you were to say, please send money to XYZ organization and it doesn't pass their due diligence test, they have the right to say, no, we will not send it to that charity. It could be some obscure non-501c3. So it must be a legitimate charity that the money is going to. And I found them to work great. You just go online, you tell them, you can even tell them what funds to use from your donor advised fund. Let's say you have different, you know, one or two or three different funds. You can say, take it out of this fund or that fund, or do it on a pro rata basis. You can also donate anonymously, which is nice. You can tell them, yes, send money to this charity, but I do not want to be recognized. That's one way to avoid a bunch of mail and spam and things like that. You can also tell the charity to use it for a specific purpose or a specific fundraising goal, for example. And I do that frequently, or you could say it's in the memory of somebody or what have you. But there's a lot of ability to define how the money should be used by the charity and whether you want to be anonymous or not. Now, here's the other thing about donor advised funds. You cannot receive anything in return for that donation. That's very important. So otherwise, it disqualifies that charitable contribution. And since you've already taken the tax deduction, it would disqualify you for that initial tax deduction. So be very careful of that. If the charity says, for instance, send us whatever dollars and we will send you this trinket or this t-shirt or whatever, decline it. You cannot receive anything of value in return for your gift from your donor advised fund. So that's another caveat there. I ended up going with Fidelity. It looks like Charles Schwab is, in essence, identical. And then if you have more assets and you are willing to always contribute at least $500, Vanguard is another option. And like I said, I'm sure there's plenty of other donor advised funds out there or custodians of donor advised funds, but those are the three I'm familiar with. And I found it very beneficial, and it has allowed me to become much more charitably inclined, because that has already been a completed gift. It's sitting there for that purpose, just like the fun bucket. So I have found these to be great ways to overcome frugality, whether it's for yourself using the fun bucket or for charity using the donor advised fund. And like I said, Mindy and Carl are going to be talking about this topic as well this week on their show, Mindy on Money. And I also talked about this a little bit in other episodes. I was on Bigger Pockets about a year ago. I think it was episode 446. We touched on the idea of the fun bucket a little bit. And that show was called Fire by 50. And that was the Bigger Pockets Money podcast. I'll link to that as well. And you've heard me talk about this fun bucket concept before, but I thought I would just dive in a little bit deeper so you could get an insight into how it came about, how I use it. And then also, while I was thinking about this topic, I just said, you know, the donor advised fund is very similar, and I should cover that in the same show. I hope you enjoyed this topic or these topics, and I will see you here next week. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.